I am pleased to present an audio recording of the workshop on an introduction to the Yoga Sutras by Patanjali that I presented to the students undergoing yoga teachers training at the Yoga Garden Yoga Studio in Apex, North Carolina. And I made this presentation on Sunday, April the 23rd, 2017. I hope you will enjoy the discussion, and as always, I would look forward to hearing back from you with your feedback, comments, or questions. Okay, so Patanjali is credited with three things that he's given us. One is the science of medicine called Ayurveda. Anybody familiar with the term Ayurveda? In what way?
Yes, that was what Sally presented about.
We had somebody come and talk.
Oh, so already you have had some discussion on Ayurveda. So that's the science of medicine in the ancient Indian system. And it's still, you know, practiced fairly widely, especially in India. There are lots of people who do that. And then he gave us the most exhaustive commentary on the Sanskrit grammar. So, you know, for purifying our speech, he gave us grammar, basically. And for purifying the mind, obviously, so the body was purified by medicine, Ayurveda, and the mind is purified by
yoga.
He gave us yoga to purify the mind. So to purify the body, Ayurveda, medicine. To purify the speech, grammar. And to purify the mind, yoga. Does that surprise anybody?
No? Surprising that one person provided all of that. That's surprising.
But does that surprise that it's yoga is for the mind? Does that surprise?
Yes, it is surprising.
It surprises me, but at the same time, I've experienced it. So it doesn't surprise me.
from the very beginning, there was something different about yoga that, you know, touched every part of me.
Right. And the reason I ask that question is that most people tend to associate yoga with just physical stretching part. You know, when you ask people, they do yoga, yes, what do? I do physical stretching called yoga. And then they ask the question, do you also do meditation? Okay. That question doesn't make sense when we talk about yoga. Yoga is meditation. Yoga is nothing but meditation. And we'll come to all that understanding as we go through this discussion. All right? So I'm assuming that you all have studied. I see this book here. You have studied some parts of Yoga Sutras, or how much have you studied already?
Just getting started in it, really.
Yeah. I like that, you know, it said in the beginning that it's not to be read like a novel from beginning to end. And, you know, I jumped around to different parts of it. So, you know, I highlighted things that
good
spoke to me.
I encourage them to focus on Yoga Sutras 1.1 to 1.14.
1.4. It's very good.
To just try to get that.
That's excellent. That's a great suggestion. It's a great starting point. In terms of the attachments that I've given you, there are five of them, five presentations that I have shared with you. So before we go on, let me just very briefly tell you what these five are. Okay. Okay. Now the first one I believe is the definition of yoga. I think the title I have given is YSP defined or something. Okay, which is what Melissa is saying. You know, the first few sutras in the chapter one, it's covers from sutra number 1 through maybe 10 or 11, basically. Okay, that's the YSP defined, or Yoga Sutra as a Patanjali defined, which is the definition of yoga. And what do you need to get to the definition of yoga? There's one more which is called the Ashtanga Yoga, which is all the 8 limbs of yoga. Is everyone familiar with roughly what the 8 limbs are? Mm-hmm. We'll be going through that anyway. So that's the second one. The third one is called Kriya, Karma and Klesha, which is essentially getting into the first part of the chapter 2, where we talk about what kleshas are. Kleshas are all the afflictions, all the pains and sufferings that we go through in life, what causes them and what is the remedy for them. That's what chapter 2 is all about. And the final recommendation that Patanjali makes is to remedy all the suffering, you have to go through these 8 limbs of yoga. So that's the most beautiful part of that whole discussion. So we end our suffering by practicing the 8 limbs of yoga. Okay. And then I have two more presentations, both titled Samyama, which is meditation, basically. So there are two final presentations on the different aspects of meditation. Because like I said, yoga is all about meditation. So there is... do you know how many sutras are in there in this whole text? How many total sutras? No. There's 195 total sutras. 195. And how many of these are allocated to the practice of asana out of 195? Anybody counted? No?
One or two.
Three. Three of them allocated to the practice of asana and meditation. Almost 2/3 of the book is all meditation. Okay, so yoga is all about meditation. I mean, asana is a part of the whole thing. 8 limbs of yoga contain asana as one of the parts of, one of those 8 limbs of yoga. So we'll get there slowly. All right. Now, in terms of time, Melissa, what's...
12:30
sharp, so no, there's no rubber band.
I doubt these folks are going to be going to the park today for lunch, so they might be okay continuing the discussion a little bit past that if we let them bring their lunch in. I don't know, we might need to wrap things up around 12:30 if they want to stay and continue past that, and they can.
How does everyone feel? Few minutes over?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Because, you know, obviously I'm not going to go through these slides. There are many, many slides, hundreds of them. So these slides are mostly for your reference in future. Okay. I'm just going to talk. And if you have questions, stop me. Don't let me go on without getting your question answered. So we'll try to make it interactive. And if you don't ask questions, I'm very fond of asking questions myself. So. All right, so it's going to be questions. All right. So let's start with understanding what yoga is as it is defined by Patanjali. And like Melissa said, let's look at the first 4 sutras first. All right. So I'm going to shut this off. So I'm not going to use this. The very first sutra is Atha. Now, I must tell you in the beginning itself, all the sutras, everything in yoga originally was given to us in this language called Sanskrit. Everyone knows that, right? So the sutras are all written in Sanskrit. Okay? So I'm going to be giving you both the Sanskrit version of the sutras, the original, and its English translation. Is that okay with everyone?
Absolutely.
Okay. So the first sutra is, and what I'm going to have to do is to ask you to repeat after me at least these first 4 sutras. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. The first one is Atha.
Atha.
Yoga.
Yoga.
Anushasanam.
Anushasanam.
Now I'm breaking these words into individual words. Okay, so Let's do it one more time. Atha.
Atha.
Yoga.
Yoga.
Anushasanam.
Anushasanam.
When you do the whole thing, Atha Yoga Anushasanam.
Atha Yoga Anushasanam.
All right. No. Yoga, obviously it says that I'm going to talk about yoga. Atha means now. Now then, therefore, Atha. Anushasanam means the discipline. So now, Patanjali says, I am going to talk about the discipline or the science or the whole, you know, the concept of yoga. That's what I'm going to talk about. Atha kind of implies that now. That means now you guys are ready. I have trained you enough that you are ready to receive this knowledge. It also means that I have the quality of the knowledge to tell you all this. And now you guys are ready to receive this knowledge we call yoga. That's the first sutra. Atha Yoga Anushasanam. The second sutra is the actual definition of yoga. Okay? Sutra number 2 in chapter 1. Alright? So let's repeat it. One word at a time. Yogash.
Yogash.
Chitta.
Chitta.
Vritti.
Vritti.
Nirodhaha.
Nirodhaha.
One more time. Yogash.
Yogash.
Chitta.
Chitta.
Vritti.
Vritti.
Nirodhaha.
Nirodhaha.
Okay, now this is one sentence you should really memorize, because when you start teaching, if you memorize this, then you can start explaining this sutra to your students. But you have to memorize it yourself first. Okay? So try to memorize this, because this is the very basic definition of yoga. There are four words in it. One is yoga, one is chitta, vritti and nirodhaha. So what do these words mean? That's what we're going to talk about now. What does the word yoga mean? what's the literal meaning of the word yoga? What's the origin of the word yoga? When you say yoga, how do you explain it to people? What does the word mean?
Union.
Union. Most commonly understood meaning is union. Union has to be among things, between things. Union of what and what? When you say union, it is uniting something, right? What is it uniting?
The individual
and everything. Hmm? Say that again.
Body and mind.
Body and mind. Mm-hmm.
Modifications. The book says mental modifications.
No. I'm talking about the word. When you explain to somebody what's yoga, what's the literal meaning of the word yoga, how do you explain that? She said union. Anybody else? I'm talking of the literal meaning of the word yoga. Union of body and mind. That's what somebody said. What else comes to mind?
Body, mind, and spirit.
Body, mind, and spirit. That's the next one comes to mind.
The individual with everything.
Individual uniting with everything. Okay. Now, when you said uniting body with mind, can you say a few more words about that? What does that mean?
The divine.
Hmm?
The divine. Uniting with the divine.
No, let's one by one. When somebody said uniting body and mind, what does that mean?
I don't know how to explain. Becoming more tranquil in your mind, and as you practice, your body and your mind become more healthy. When you join thought with, I don't really know how to explain.
That's okay. It's a question.
Mm-hmm. Your mind overcomes, helps your body overcome physical limitations.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. And somebody said spirit. What does that mean?
To me, spirit means bringing the divine, God, a higher power into yourself.
So uniting mind, body, and spirit, is that the word you used?
Yes.
Okay. Everyone else okay with all that? Okay. I'm going to leave it at that. I'm not going to answer that question yet. Because as we go along, we'll answer that question. All right? So, you know, we'll build up to that. We'll build up to the answer to that question. All right? But right now, I just wanted to get your own views on what yoga is. So, the common feeling is that yoga is the union, and union between a few things. What those things are, we'll know. We'll find out. All right? Let's leave it at that. Chitta means, there is a second word is chitta. Chitta means mind. Chitta is the mind. All right? And I'm going to explain that. Vritti, the third word, vritti means
modification.
Modification, fluctuations, changes that are constantly going on. There is constant agitation in the mind, constant perturbations, changes, moment to moment. That's the vritti part. And nirodha means a sense of control, restraint, keeping in check, you know, that's nirodha. So if I were to build an English sentence around these Sanskrit words, the sentence would sound like this. Yoga, by definition, is the nirodha of the vrittis that are happening in the chitta. Does that make sense? Yoga is the nirodha, or cessation, or restraint, or keeping in check of the vrittis, which are all the fluctuations, all the changes, all the agitations, the dialogues that we're constantly going through in the mind. That is yoga. Right? So now if you want to restrain something which is going on in the mind, first of all we have to understand what is mind. So that's our next challenge, is to understand what is mind. Okay, so if you've read this commentary by Swami Satchidananda, he gives a very beautiful example. Okay, and I'm going to elaborate on that example. Okay, so the first thing that is commonly recommended in our ancient texts is that think of the mind as a composite of four different functions. There are four things that are going on in the mind. And so what are the things going on in the mind? What does the mind do, basically? What are the things that are happening in the mind? That, like I said, I'm going to ask a lot of questions.
Thinking.
That's the number one thing that's going on, is thinking. What else is going on?
Decision making.
Very good. So let's leave it at that. That's okay. Thinking, decision making. What else?
Worrying
is, I'm going to club that with thinking. Thinking, worrying, you know, all those things. That's part of the thinking. Broad category. What else?
Feeling.
That's all part of thinking.
It's all thinking. And interpreting senses is the same.
That's the same thing as decision making. We're talking of major categories.
Controlling like things that happen in your body.
That's all decision making. Let me give you a hint. Everything is based on something that is already there in the mind. It's called memory. Everyone got that? Memory. All decisions are based on memory. Everything. Everyone okay with that? And the final fourth function is called the, you may not be able to guess it very quickly, but it's called the ego. E-G-O. Anybody heard of that? No? Okay. That's called the ego. So there are four broad categories of functions which are done by the mind. Okay? The mind, the thinking, or we also call it the cognitive function. Cognition happens through the five senses. So we receive input through the five senses. We also provide input through the five, you know, through the nervous system, through the senses. Okay? So I can touch and feel something that is being communicated to my brain. And then my mind can say, okay, lift it up. You know, that's the motor function. All right? It's all happening through the cognitive function. Also worrying, willing, desiring, you know, being ambitious, all that is happening. That's all clubbed under the function that's called the mind, right? Thinking function, cognitive. And there are Sanskrit words for each one of these. The thinking function is called manas in Sanskrit, manas, M-A-N-A-S. The decision-making is called intellect in English, the intellectual function. And the Sanskrit term for that is buddhi, B-U-D-D-H-I. Buddhi. That's the intellect trying to make a choice among multiple options that are presented at every moment in life. The memory is everything that we do, we think, you know, whatever happens in life, everything gets stored in our memory. Everything. Okay, and every decision has to be based on memory. Has to be. Okay. And finally, the ego is the, what's ego?
Yourself.
Hmm?
Yourself.
What's ego? What does it mean, yourself? What does the ego do?
You must think of it as like a protective kind of thing.
Protective, okay. What's ego? In the context of yoga, ego has been given a very kind of specific understanding. Okay, so what's ego? Give an example of how you use the word ego in your life, everyday life.
Putting yourself out there first instead of being.
What's in it for me?
Someone else.
What's in it for me? That's ego. Right? So ego is the one which makes statements like, I'm the best. I'm the best mother, I'm the best grandmother, or I'm the worst, I'm ugly, I'm handsome, I'm rich, I'm poor, I'm good, I'm bad. You know, I'm the best yoga teacher, nobody can beat me. All those statements are made by the ego. Identification. Okay. Ego, first of all, it gives us an identity that I am the teacher or I am the student or I am the father. That's an identity. I am the CEO of this company. But then it also loves to add adjectives to everything. I am the best teacher. I am the worst human being. You know, oh, I own this palatial building, you know. Or I own a Mercedes car which is best in my neighborhood. You know. All those beautiful labels is what the ego loves to attach. You meet a person for the very first time, but you already have an impression. This guy looks like a good person, this guy looks like a bad person. You make up your mind right away without ever having met a person. That's all done beautifully by the ego. So the story that Swami Satchidananda gives, you know, is something like this, right? It's all in the first, in the explanation, all right? At the end of the day, you're coming back from work, for example. You might be a little hungry at the end of the day, so you are naturally drawn toward the kitchen, right? But the moment you get closer to the kitchen, you start smelling something, and you're drawn to that smell. So cognitive function, right? I said mind does the cognitive function. Cognition has started now. The first thing is sense of smell. When you go close to it, sense of sight. You can actually see a piece of cake sitting on the counter, kitchen countertop. Now you have engaged the sense of sight. Then your intuition says, I want to engage the sense of touch by dipping your finger into it, getting a feel for it, texture, you know, what does it feel like, etc. Sense of touch. And finally, you want to engage the sense of
taste.
Putting it into the tongue and then seeing, you know, at least getting a feel for what it tastes like. Okay. Now the cognition has been done. The mind has received all the information about this cake, and now it is time to make a decision. Because there are choices. What are the choices here?
To eat it or not.
To eat it or not to eat. It's very simple. But we decided that the function of the mind that makes decision is called the intellect. Okay? So mind has obtained all this information. It's going to pass that information to the intellect. Hey, intellect, tell me what I should do with it. You are the decision maker. In our current state of affairs, unfortunately, the way things are, the intellect is not able to make independent decisions because it is controlled by a boss called the ego. Ego likes to make decisions, take charge, and then keep control over everything. So knock, knock, boss. You know, the boss says, what? I want to make a decision. Here are the pieces of information that I have. What do I do? Ego says, it's very simple. Let me try to look into the memory. All the decision is based on the memory, right? Goes into the memory, pulls up an instance of my having had the same cake about a week ago, and then it puts a label on that. Obviously, like I said, everything gets labeled. Ego has put a label there, divine. That experience of that eating that cake was divine, delightful. Okay, that's the label it reads. Decision is very simple. He says, tell the mind to activate the motor functions, do the needful. When it comes back to the intellect, the buddhi, it says, but I am the decision maker. Let me make some private investigation of my own. Where do you go for decision making? Into the memory. Pulls up another instance of memory, somewhat related. What does it show? It shows that I had a visit with my doctor a few days ago. Based on my blood work, my cholesterol levels came up to be dangerously high. And I was asked to meet with a nutritionist, so the nutritionist can guide me. And I just met with the nutritionist 2 days ago. The guidance given to me was that anything that resembles this piece of cake is very dangerous for you. You should stay away from it. We all know that, right? So the intellect is very alarmed. Knock, 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 boss. Hey, what's it now? Look what I found. I'm not supposed to eat this cake. Guess what the boss says? You are an idiot. You're so stupid not to read that label. It says divine. How can you pass a divine experience? Right? So that's how the mind functions. Everyone got the idea? The message is very clear. Who wins? We know that. Anybody doubts that? Who wins? No? Okay. So, that's the way the mind functions today, that it is controlled by the ego. Right? And that's what causes all these fluctuations in the mind, all these perturbations in the mind in the first place. But the Yoga Sutra says, Patanjali says, that we have to learn how to control these fluctuations, how to restrain them, how to put them in perspective. That's the definition of yoga. What would that take? That would take the reversal of the roles of ego and the intellect. And only we can make decisions which are appropriate for us and keep the mind calm, stable, peaceful, tranquil.
I have a question. In the cake example. Is there a fluctuation there? Is that the
cake is causing the fluctuation? The moment
the back and forth
everything and no fluctuation is even when we look at the cake, that's considered a fluctuation because now we have an image of the cake. When we smell it, that's caused a fluctuation, because now it's giving us a feel for the smell and the taste of it. All those are fluctuations.
So just even the experience.
Even the experiences. But it's changing from moment to moment because of the ego puts a lot of labels onto that. Everything becomes a fluctuation then. The point is, can we restrain those and not be dependent on the ego? That's the whole idea. Now, let's move on to the third and fourth sutras before we keep going. Okay, so the third sutra is, okay, I want you to repeat that. Tada.
Tada.
Drashtuhu.
Drashtuhu.
Swarupe.
Swarupe.
Avasthanam.
Avasthanam.
So again, one more time. Tada.
Tada.
Drashtuhu.
Drashtuhu.
Swarupe.
Swarupe.
Avasthanam.
Avasthanam.
Okay. So, tada means then, now, drashtuhu is a word that will need a much longer time to explain. It means the observer, the one who is watching, the one who is seeing everything. Drashtuhu. What does that mean? What does that mean when you say observer?
Is that how things are collected, like in the memory?
What's the observer? What's the meaning of the word observer here? Well, what the whole sentence means, let me give you the meaning of this sentence. What this means is, the observer, swarupa means it in its own true nature. So the observer gets established in its own true nature. That's the meaning of this third sutra. The observer, when tada means then, when we have controlled the mind, when we have subdued the vrittis or the fluctuations of the mind, when we have done that, then tada, then the observer can stay established in its own true nature. What does that sentence mean now? That's the big question.
So are we talking about the memory now? The memories?
I'm asking this question.
Well,
so go ahead.
I feel like we didn't talk about that previously.
Okay.
And it's something that fascinated me as I was going through all the readings that we've done so far for the class, and how we drag all this stuff with us that's happened, made me see it again. And, that forms our opinion of ourself and our decision making, and probably what our ego is telling us too, because of memories, because of past experiences.
So what's the observer here? Or who is the observer here?
I guess maybe the ego is the observer.
Any other thoughts?
The mind in general.
Any other thoughts?
The thought that came to my mind was just control. I mean, you learn to control those.
That's what the second sutra said. You learn to control the fluctuations of the mind, but when you do that, when you are able to accomplish that goal, then the observer gets established, can stay in its own true nature. So that's a very loaded statement. It's a very, very deep loaded statement. That's why I said it can take a long time to explain all that. But I'm going to give it a try. In the short time that we have, I'm going to give it a try. The whole philosophy of yoga that's given to us by Patanjali is actually based on another ancient philosophy, and the name of that philosophy is Sankhya. Anybody heard that term? S-A-N-K-H-Y-A, Sankhya philosophy. Okay? When you get doubts, check with these two people. They will tell you what that Sankhya is. Okay? Now, according to that philosophy, like I said, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, the philosophy contained in these is based on that ancient philosophy. Most of the tenets are based on that. According to that philosophy, there are two entities that we're talking about, two independent entities. One is called, in the terminology used there, it's called Purusha, P-U-R-U-S-H-A, Purusha. And the second entity is called Prakriti, P-R-A-K-R-I-T-I, Prakriti. Okay. In common parlance, Purusha equates with our concept of the soul, the spirit, the self. Okay, that's what Purusha is. So that's one entity, the soul or the spirit or the self. And the second entity is Prakriti, which is everything that you and I can think of, feel, whatever. Right? That's all this human structure, you can say. The physical body, the mind, intellect, thoughts, everything is called Prakriti. All right? But these two are independent of each other. They are not a part of each other. Now that concept is something that is so germane to the philosophy of yoga. Okay, and as long as, you know, until we understand that concept, we cannot be considered a yogi. We have to become fully established in that concept that this soul is separate from the rest of what we think is everything else. This entire universe, this entire physical human structure, which includes the physical body, mind, intellect, everything. They're two separate entities. So the first thing that comes to mind is, when I say yoga is the union of mind, body and spirit, that cannot be true. Because we just said that yoga, or these two entities are actually independent of each other. They are not joined. So yoga essentially is the separation of spirit from the rest of the stuff. Not the union, it's the separation or an understanding that this spirit or this self or this soul or Purusha is separate from what I consider to be the body, mind, etc. So the first message you want to carry with you is that the spirit is not identified with the body. It should be considered totally separate. And only when we have that realization, we attain the full objective of yoga. Is to attain that realization that spirit is separate from this body. It's not identified with the body. And Patanjali says that realization doesn't happen very easily. It can take multiple lifetimes. It will take multiple lifetimes. So he's given us a kind of a preview of how long it might take. Does that mean we never make a start? It's up to us. If we don't make a start, we'll never get there. So it's up to us to decide what we want to do. And as far as I can tell you, you already have made a start by practicing yoga. That's the start. Now, the statement here is that that observer will establish itself in its own true nature. That observer is that what is being referred to is the soul, the spirit, the self, the Atma, Purusha. That's what is being referred to. That's the observer. That's one that's observing everything else that's going on in this mind-body complex. But in our current state of being, we are totally identified with the ego. Our ego rules supreme. And the ego thinks that I am this Purusha, I am this spirit, and we are identified with it, we don't know any different, and therefore we are in a state of mess. But to clear this mess, to clear this fog that we are in, we are practicing yoga, and Patanjali says when you do that, now when you have been able to completely, you know, control what's going on in the mind, then only this Purusha, then this spirit can establish itself in its true nature, which is pure by itself, not identified with the body and mind. And it can rest there and continue the job of observing us. That's it. Like I said, this is a deep concept. It takes a lot of introspection, reflection, and understanding to get that concept. Okay? But make a start. That's the whole idea. Make a start. Get to that point somewhere. Sometime in the future. Keep that in mind though. Okay? And then, so that's the third sutra. What's the number four sutra? Anybody? Vritti. Okay, let's read that. Vritti. Sarupyam. Sarupyam. Itaratra.
Itaratra.
So, vritti sarupyam itaratra.
Vritti sarupyam itaratra.
Right. All right. Itaratra means otherwise. Itaratra means otherwise, on the other hand. So if you are able to control your mind, nirodhaha, which is in the second sutra, then the observer or the purusha or the self can establish itself in its own true nature, which is being separate from the mind-body complex. If you don't do that, if you're not able to control your mind, then vritti, the fluctuations that are going on in the mind, which is caused by the ego, they take over and your mind is filled with that. That means ego remains in control. It controls your life. It tells you, this is good, this is bad, this is ugly, this is handsome, and you are all the time confused and conflicted and afflicted and painful and everything. So Patanjali is giving us a choice. Either we learn how to control the mind or be controlled by it. Very simple choice. You decide, what do you want to do? Do you want to be in charge, in the driver's seat? Or you want to be driven by this ego and let it take you wherever it wants to go? So those are the first four sutras which are basically defining what yoga is. As we can all see, it's all about the mind. It didn't say anything about going to the warrior pose and or into the Hanuman pose or whatever. Right? So, again, a very quick recap of these four sutras. The first one says, I'm going to now give you an understanding of the discipline of this whole understanding of yoga, Atha Yoga Anushasanam. Yoga, by definition, is the ability to control the mind or calm the mind. All the fluctuations, all the perturbations that are going on in the mind, I want to learn how to calm those. If I can do that, then my true essence, I can recognize who I am, I truly am. Right? Then only I can understand what my true identity is, only by calming the mind, I can understand what my true identity is. And that happens to be the spirit. My true identity is nothing but the spirit. But I am identified with the ego, or my intellect, or my body, and therefore I am in a state of mess. So these are the first four sutras, which are the very essential definition of yoga. So this suggestion, this recommendation that Melissa and John have made, perfect. Please understand these four sutras very thoroughly. Go into as much depth as you can of understanding these, and they should remain with you whenever you 24 hours of the day, basically. Because then yoga becomes a lifestyle. It's not something that you, for an hour on the mat, it's a lifestyle. Yoga is all about life. It's not about just asana practice. Everyone got that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the next few sutras, any question on this first four things that we did so far?
Yeah, but...
we don't have all week, right?
I guess my question was around, I can't remember now.
Okay, while you think about it.
Okay.
The reason I'm asking, you know, if you have questions is, and you said we don't have all week. You know, it depends on us what we want to do, right? Do we want to develop a better understanding of even one concept here, or do we want to have a broad perspective and then don't let it take a week? I mean, it's up to us. We decide that, right? There's one way is to, you know, if you have a question, get that answered. Otherwise, it'll stay at the back of your mind and keep bothering you. On the other hand, you know, if you want to have a broader perspective and then go into the depth, that's another way of approaching this. Okay? Fine with either one. I'm okay with either approach. All right? But let me just go on now. The next few sutras are all about the... Yes?
I remember it.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
How can the Purusha be confused?
It's not the Purusha which is confused. It is the ego which is making the confusion happen. It's identifying the Purusha with itself, and therefore everything is confused.
Okay. So it's the ego.
That's it's the ego which is causing all the problems. Ego, intellect, you know, they kind of work together, or, you know, that's how it is.
How is it then that I feel confused?
That's because of the ego. But what the ego is saying is that I'd love to put labels on things. And even though we have no idea what things are, we have never tasted a particular food, but the ego says, it looks yucky, I don't want to try it. You're confused already, right? We don't even know what it's going to taste like, but the ego has already put a label on it, and we already have made our mind, it's going to be yucky, so I don't even want to try. That's confusion. That's the state of...
The normal state of confusion.
Hmm?
The normal state of confusion.
Confusion. You're always in that state.
The water we swim in.
So, ego is responsible for all that. Okay? And, so the next few sutras are all about understanding what these five vrittis are. There are five vrittis. Again, broad categories of vrittis. Vritti are the fluctuations, right? Five ways that things happen in the mind. Five different vrittis or five different manners in which things fluctuate in the mind. So, quickly, does anybody want to read those five vrittis? Tell me what these five are. Just very quickly. Or do you want to repeat after me?
Repeat
after me. First one is pramana.
Pramana.
Pramana. Viparayaya.
Viparayaya.
Viparayaya. Vikalpa.
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 Nidra.
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 Nidra. Smriti.
Smriti.
Smriti. So pramana. So again, pramana.
Pramana.
Viparyaya.
Viparyaya.
Vikalpa.
Vikalpa.
Nidra.
Nidra.
Smriti.
Smriti.
Okay, those are the five that are mentioned by Patanjali. Okay. Does everyone got that?
Yeah, I think we have different editions of the book.
Okay. No, it doesn't matter. It's got to be there. Number five sutra. Number five says there are five vrittis. Okay, number five is vrittaya panchatayaha klishta klishtaha. Right? So number 5 sutra says there are 5 vrittis which can be either afflicted or non-afflicted, painful or non-painful. And sutra number 6 will list all those 5 vrittis now. What are these? Can you read sutra number 6?
Pramana.
That's what we talked about. Pramana, Vipariya,
Vikalpa, Nitra and
Smriti.
Smith.
You found it, right?
Yes.
That's what we talked about. So these are the 5 ways in which the mind can be disturbed. Okay? And I'm not going to spend too much time on this. You can spend time later on. Pramana is the kind of right knowledge that we receive through the 5 senses predominantly. Okay? It can be either coming through the 5 senses or it can be inferred based on what we have experienced in the past. Okay, so that's number 2. The third way, right knowledge comes in through a person or a text that we believe has the truth in it. Scriptural knowledge, for example. If you believe that certain scripture has the knowledge, then we believe that, trust that. Or a teacher, for example. Or an elderly person, whatever. So three manners in which we can get right knowledge, which is called pramana. Then viparyaya is all kinds of confused knowledge, which is what we are always in, confused knowledge, wrong knowledge. A common example given is that, you know, in all our ancient texts, they give this example. In a dimly lit night for evening time, you know, when there is very little light left, you see something curled, lying on the road, and you think it's a snake, and you run away out of fear. Somebody else coming in with a flashlight, flashes the light on it, and finds that it's only a piece of rope. Okay, but we already have been scared out of our wits and all that. We are so scared of snakes. So that's called the viparyaya, wrong knowledge. Vikalpa is all imaginary knowledge. You hear something and suddenly get ideas, you know. Purely imaginary ideas. And nidra is sleep, deep sleep. And smriti is all the memories that we just talked about. So these are the 5 ways in which mind can get these fluctuations, get changes. Okay. Like I said, I don't plan to spend too much time on this. Please go through these on your own. If you have questions, you can always ask. All right. But there are 5 broad categories of these fluctuations that can impact our mind. Okay? Multiple ways. And these things are happening all the time, 24 hours of the day. Everything. Okay? Everyone okay?
Mm-hmm.
In 24 hours of the day, we can be in either one of the 3 states, as we know. One is called the waking state. In Sanskrit it's called Jagrata Avastha. The second state can be dreaming state. Right? So we can be either in waking state or dreaming state, and finally we can be in third state is
sleeping.
When there are no dreams. Deep sleep. Only 3 possible states. Yes, maybe. Is there a 4th state possible? No? That's your homework. Okay. So, the homework assignment is find out if there is a 4th state possible beyond these 3. Okay? Please do this homework assignment. And if you find out, please write me an email. Yeah, I would like to hear that. Okay, so all our experiences in these 3 states can be broadly put into these 5 categories of experiences. That's the whole idea. Okay? 5 vrittis. Now, the next couple of sutras tell us how we can handle these fluctuations of the mind. And again, in a broad sense, right? Broad sense. So there are two things mentioned here by Patanjali. And I don't offhand remember the sutra number. It could be 11 or 10 or something. After the discussion on the five vrittis, he said there are two things that we have to do. One is called, in Sanskrit, it's called abhyasa. That's all, repeat that word, abhyasa.
Abhyasa.
And the second word is vairagya.
Vairagya.
So abhyasa vairagya.
Abhyasa vairagya.
Okay. The sutra says, let's repeat the sutra now. Abhyasa.
Abhyasa.
Vairagya bhyam.
Vairagya bhyam.
Tat nirodha.
Tat
or tan nirodha is what it is.
Tan
nirodha. What number is that?
12.
Okay. So what does it mean? It says nirodha. We understood the word nirodha means cessation or control or, you know, diminishing something. That thing. So tan nirodha means of these five fluctuations that are listed, their nirodha, their constraint, their control can be done through the practice, through abhyasa and vairagya. All right, that's the literal meaning of that sentence. Abhyasa vairagya abhyam tan nirodha. That means their control, the control of these five vrittis that are happening in the mind, can be achieved through one, abhyasa, which is practice, constant practice. And secondly, through vairagya, which is, what's vairagya?
Non-attachment.
Okay, so through practice and non-attachment, we can attain our final goal of calming the mind. All right, what's abhyasa?
Practice.
How does it? How is it defined by Patanjali? Okay, it probably is the next one, sutra, or the one after that. But let me just quickly recite the sutra in Sanskrit first, and then we can understand the meaning. So the sutra is Satu Dirgha Ka. I'm not going to ask you to repeat that, but you can read that. Satu Dirgha Kala Nairantarya Satkara Sevitaha Dridbhumihi. Now, each word is very meaningful here. Dirgha Kala means, Kala is time duration, Dirgha is long. A very long, so the practice should be done for a very long period of time. That's number one. Long period of time. How long? How long? How many days, months, weeks?
As long as it takes.
Multiple lifetimes. We just said that. Patanjali says it's going to take multiple lifetimes. That's how long you have to practice yoga to attain the goal of yoga. Okay, one lifetime will not be enough for this. So that's the Dirgha Kala, long time. Nairantarya means uninterrupted, without any breaks, without any disruption, totally uninterrupted. If you're living the lifestyle of yoga, it's 24 hours a day. If you want to associate with your own yoga practice, for example, you know, asana, pranayama, meditation, whatever else you take, on a very regular basis. No breaks. No interruptions. Okay? That's number two. Nairantarya. Satkara sevitaha means, satkar means a sense of devotion, a sense of trust, faith, commitment. Those are all the kind of shades of meaning of satkara. So it should be done, it should be practiced with a total sense of devotion, faith, commitment, etc., etc. So when practice is done for a very long time, without any interruption, and with a sense of devotion or trust or faith, then only it becomes firmly established. Practice. So now you can see, you know, what it takes to practice. All right? That's the definition of the word abhyasa or practice. Okay. Then, man, again, we're not going to spend too much time on the non-attachment part, but that itself is a subject in itself. Okay, but there are, according to Mr. Patanjali, two stages of non-attachment. Okay, now, of course, you have to understand that we are not talking just of non-attachment, we are also talking of detachment. There are two things considered here, okay? Vairagya has the shades of both. What's the distinction between non-attachment and detachment? Come on, come on, come on, come on. English words. What's the difference? Non-attachment and detachment.
One means you were never attached to it, and the other means that you were and you're detaching.
There you go. Beautiful. Beautiful. That's what we want. First goal is not to get attached to anything. Not to get attached at all. But in our life, that's not happening. We have already lived our life and now we understand the sutra. So that means by now we are already attached to a few things. Now we have to detach ourselves from those things that we are already attached to. So that's the concept of vairagya. Right? Then he says there are two kind of stages. One is, people just translate that as a lower form of vairagya and the highest form of vairagya, or higher form. In the lower state of vairagya, he says that you have to unattach yourself from the five senses. That means you are not attached to the sense of smell, touch, taste, etc. Zero attachment. No attachment to food, no attachment to any touch, any kind of smell or vision or view, you know, anything. You're not attached to it. That's the lower vairagya. That means I'm not addicted to my coffee. I'm not addicted to my watching my TV. I'm not addicted to or attached to any kind of music. I'm not attached to my house, my bank account, my clothes, everything. That's the lower form of vairagya. Trust me, that's what he says.
Did you say this sense of touch? You're not attached to that?
Mm-hmm.
So no hugs or embraces or
anything? No, you're not attached to them.
Yeah.
You do them. You do them, you're not attached to them. That means if you don't get a hug, are you going to get upset?
I'm going to fall apart.
Hmm?
I'm going to fall apart.
That's attached.
What about asana practice?
Hmm?
What about an asana practice?
Yeah, exactly the same thing. If you're attached to your asana practice, if you don't do it in the morning, for example, oh my God, I'm miserable, I missed my asana practice. That's attachment. Or you may be attached to one particular pose. Warrior pose. Oh, my body is not in alignment. I'm miserable, you know. That's attachment.
So you could like the smell of something, but you're just not attached.
You're not attached to it.
Got it.
You can like, you have to like the smell of something, you know, like or dislike, whatever, but not attached to it. That means if you like a smell and you don't get it, are you miserable? Are you going to say, oh my God, you know, I wish I had that. Attachment. You know, when I was a student, when I moved to this country, I was in Nebraska. Okay? I was doing my master's there, engineering, computer science. And on a given day, on Sundays in that state, you could not buy drinks. That was the case in those days. On Sundays, you could not buy. I'm sure that...
It's 1 o'clock on Sunday.
Okay, anyway, in those days, in Nebraska, we could not buy a drink on Sundays. Now, one of my friends was absolutely attached to his beer. He could not live without it. Okay? It was winter time. It was minus 30 degrees temperature. Minus 30, trust me. And he drove at the middle of the night to the next state, which is called Iowa. all the way to get a beer. Mm-hmm. I'm just giving you an example of attachment.
Attachment.
Driving middle of the night, minus 30 degree temperature, to another state to get beer. Okay. That's how deep our attachments are. We may not get to that extreme, but we all do that in some extent.
Brother things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's the lower level of attachment or non-attachment. The higher level is when you can go past the attachment to the three gunas. What are the three gunas? Anybody know what the three gunas are? No? That's why this two-hour session is not a very... There's no way you can cover everything. Okay, so you have to go past these three gunas. They are called sattva. Let's repeat these words. Sattva.
Sattva.
Rajas.
Rajas.
And tamas.
Tamas.
Sattva, rajas and tamas. These are the three gunas. And usually I spend about another two-hour workshop to explain, you know, the concept of the gunas.
We talked about it a little bit with Ayurveda.
Oh, you did? Okay. I'm glad. Yeah. Okay. I'm glad you did that.
Remember those words from the Ayurveda?
I don't remember what they mean, but I remember the words.
She might have just mentioned the words then.
Okay, I'm glad you did that. Okay. But the concept is that everything in this material universe called Prakriti is a combination of these three gunas. Everything. Material or non-material. Okay. Sattva is the concept of purity. Everything that is good, pure, clean, you know, that's sattva. Rajas implies motion, ambition, movement, desire. You know, all those are associated with rajas. Movement, gung ho, type A personality. That's all rajas. Oh, I want to be there. I want to be the CEO. You know, want to become this and want to become the best teacher, yoga instructor, or driven by rajas.
So sorry,
it's the Kool-Aid man.
Okay. That's rajas because she was really focused on coming here in time. You know, rajas driven. Okay, and tamas is the. Is the opposite. You just become totally dull. You're sleep-headed. You're sleepy, and you just want to do nothing. My mind is fried. I'm a couch potato. All I want to do is to sit in my sofa and with a bag full of potatoes, with a glass of beer, and watch football. That's all I want. Or, you know, I have negative tendencies. Like, you know, when you get angry, it's also caused by tamas. When you get jealous. Or you want to hit somebody or kill somebody. It's all kind of clubbed into that category of tamas.
Far cry between the two of those.
So sattva, rajas and tamas. And everything in this universe is a composite of these three. Mm-hmm. And we are always attached to whatever is happening based on these three. So what Patanjali says, we can create a complete balance of these three. Originally they were all in a state of balance. Before this creation happened, before this human form was created, everything was in a state of balance. And we want to get back to that state of balance eventually. That's the highest form of vairagya or non-attachment. So we are not even attached to anything that's going on. Like I said, I'm not going to spend time on that concept. It's not something that you can understand in these 5 minutes. But please keep that in mind. And do some more, you know, some more reading and some more reflection on your own. Okay? All right. So, I'm running out of time.
Donna had asked a question in our last weekend about karma.
Well, I was interested in the sutras that led you to understand more about fear.
Oh, yes, the different types of...
So, that's the beginning of chapter 2. If you see the chapter 2, it talks about five kleshas, five forms of affliction, or five causes of affliction or suffering or pain. The very first few sutras in the chapter 2. Okay? So what it says is there are five afflictions, right? Five kleshas. Alright? So let's all repeat those five kleshas, first of all, in Sanskrit. Number 1, avidya.
Avidya.
Number 2, asmita.
Asmita.
Number 3, raga.
Raga.
Dvesha.
Dvesha.
Abhinivesha.
Abhinivesha.
So, avidya.
Avidya.
Asmita.
Asmita.
Raga.
Raga.
Dvesha.
Dvesha.
Abhinivesha.
Abhinivesha.
The word abhinivesha is the literal meaning of abhinivesha. Because you mentioned the word fear, okay, the literal meaning of the word abhinivesha is the desire to maintain status quo. Desire to have no change in our life. If we are comfortable with something, we want to maintain it that way. We don't want to venture into something new or something uncharted territory. Why? Because of fear. Fear of the unknown. Fear of something that has not happened before. Right? That's fear. And the ultimate fear that Patanjali talks about and most other commentators say is the fear of death. We are deathly afraid of death. Right? So that's all fear. Abhinivesha, the last of the afflictions, is fear. Fear of death. The strong desire to stay in the most comfortable of states, which we think is comfortable, which may not be actually. Okay? We might be totally confused. What causes this fear now? What causes this fear is the previous two, raga and dvesha. I'm starting with fear because you mentioned the word fear, right? Raga and dvesha. What's raga?
Attachment.
Attachments. What's dvesha?
Hatred,
dislike, all those things. Now, who puts these labels?
Ego.
Ego. The word in this sutra that's used by Patanjali for ego is asmita. Asmita. The word asmita means ego. Ego gives rise to raga and dvesha, which is attachments and dislikes or hatred, because, like we said, ego loves to put these labels. Oh, I love it. I hate it. I want it. I don't want it. I want to have nothing to do with it. Okay? Right? So at the end of this class, you know, you would have put a label in your memory. I liked the class. I hated it. I wanted to have it back again. I never want to see the face of this instructor. Those are things that which you'll put labels on in your own memory bank. Right? And that's all a part of raga and dvesha. Because if you violate raga, for example, if you light the class and you're never able to see me again, there'll be and then there is a kind of fear, will I be able to get to this kind of a class again? Or if you've disliked it, there's a fear. Oh my God, what if this guy comes back? Oh my God, you know, I'm going to have such a miserable time. Right? Those are the fears that are caused by raga and dvesha. Likes and dislikes. Attachments and hatreds, so to say. All caused by this entity called the ego, which by the term used is asmita. Ego. And what's the mother of all these things? What causes all these in the first place? The number one, klesha, which is what we said is, what's the number one? We just repeated all these five.
Oh.
First one was? Okay, let's read that. Come on. We just replied. Avidya. 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 Avidya is knowledge. Avidya is lack of understanding, lack of knowledge. Avidya is the mother of all these afflictions, the sufferings. Avidya. What's avidya? Ignorance. What does it mean, ignorance?
To not know.
Yeah. What is it that we don't know? We know everything. What is it we don't know?
Hmm? We don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, we can always guess. Ego loves to guess. It's going to tell you what's going to happen. You know, it's going to tell you. If your son is out late at night, it's going to tell you he's going to meet with an accident. And if he's 10 more minutes late, he already met with an accident. That's what ego is telling you. If my husband is not back home in time, ego is going to tell you he's with some other woman. So we already know that. What's ignorance? That's what we started with. Ignorance is not knowing that my true identity, my true self, is separate from this mind and body. We just said that, right? And because of that lack of understanding, I'm letting my ego take over everything. That's ignorance. Once I know my stuff, and once I know that I have a purely independent entity, I have an existence purely independent of this mind and body, then I'm not depending on the ego. Then the ego has very little role to play. It has a role to play, but not of this labeling and being dependent on everything else. Now I'm able to make decisions based on the intellect. Because now the intellect can be driven by my pure intuitive wisdom that has been hidden by the ego. Ego puts a lid on that intuition, intuitive wisdom. Because that wisdom comes from the reflection or the light of Purusha or the soul. The soul is giving you light. And that light lights up our intuition, which is the pure innate wisdom that we all have, but the ego does not want you to access that. It puts a lid on that, covers that completely, it's fogged up. Because the intuition will say something totally different. Ego doesn't like it, and it has no more role to play. Now, if you allow the pure intuition to play a role, ego cannot point fingers. You're causing me trouble. You're the reason why I'm suffering. You're the reason for my stress. And ego cannot point fingers.
I have a question that's kind of abstract, I guess. It's kind of a chicken or the egg kind of concept. But I wonder how it's explained, like where the ego started from.
Ego started from the very beginning of life, of universe. It's there. It doesn't have a beginning. What they say is, ego is beginningless, but does have an end. The negative aspect of the ego can be controlled finally, but it's beginningless. It came with us. Because we are born with our own bag of karma. Somebody said karma. What's karma, right? Can we talk about that now? It's all related, right? It's all related. Because we are born with our own bag of karmas. What does that mean? What does it mean when we say we are born with our own bag of karmas?
Whatever we did in a previous iteration of this follows us.
Yeah, absolutely, that's right. Previous iterations, multiple. How many? Innumerable. You can't count them. It's right from Adam and Eve time. Who knows?
Times immemorial.
Now, what does this bag of karma contain? It contains all our, actions that we did and the memory of everything that we did. Any kind of bad karma, good karma that we did, it's going to have an imprint of that. It's also going to have an imprint of what are we going to be like in our future life, etc. It's a lot of things. Okay, so there are three. Now, this is not given in Patanjali, but our texts tell you there are three forms of karmas, three types of karmas. Okay, the Sanskrit terms are one is called Sanchita Karma, the second is called Prarabdha Karma, and the third is called Agami Karma. Okay, now what do these terms mean? Sanchit Karma is the total collection of all our karma bank, so to say, or of the entire bag or the entire bank balance from multiple lifetimes. That's called Sanchita. We have collected all that into our karma bag. Now, when a person is born, when a person is given new life, okay, you are given a subset of this entire collection of bank balance to live this life. So if you have $1 million, maybe you are given 100,000 to live this life now. That's called prarabdha karma. And that may have things like which family you are going to be born, what's going to be your height, what's going to be your color, your shape, size, what kind of mind you will have, what kind of attitudes you will have, etc., etc. How many illnesses you will have, when will you fall sick, all that is a part of that prarabdha karma. It's predefined by us, for us. And then the third kind of karma is called agami karma, which is what we create in this life because of our something that we have been given. It's called free will. Okay? Now, based on our free will, which hopefully is directed by our intellect, it could be directed by the ego also, and unfortunately that's what happens. But free will is going to create more karma for us. If we now do something, it can be labeled as, a good karma or bad karma, and based on that, everything gets labeled and then everything gets put into the same bag of karmas. Now, because our true nature, which is our soul or the spirit, is identified with the ego and all this entire bag, so to say, this whole thing is called the subtle body. The English term for that is subtle body. There is the gross body. Everyone knows these three terms or no? No?
Really?
Okay. There are three bodies, they say. Gross body, which is this physical structure made of the five elements. Earth. Everyone knows the five elements? Mm-hmm. What are the five elements?
Earth, water, fire, air, ether.
Okay, five elements, right? So this whole physical structure is a composite of these five elements. It's called the gross body. The subtle body is what's inside us, like the ego is a part of the subtle body. Our mind is a part of the subtle body. The five senses, the sense of smell, touch, taste, etc., they are all part of the subtle body. All right? So now this soul or this spirit, which is identified with all this, it's all one. All that is called the subtle body, and that is going to be, at the time of the physical death, when this body disappears physically, this whole structure, which is called the subtle body, is going to be transported and put into a new physical body. Okay? That's the whole concept of reincarnation in our Indian culture, in yoga culture. That this subtle body is now going to be transported into a new physical body, and because of that, it carries all this bag of karma. Good, bad, indifferent, ugly, handsome, everything. And everything gets transported into that. And a part of that whole collection, which is given as a part of the karma, is called the prarabdha karma, which is the one that is subset of that which is put into our bag. That's the whole concept of karma theory. I hope it's a very kind of a brief outline of karma theory. All right. So the whole idea is to eventually get rid of this bag, right? So we're not reborn. The concept of yoga is eventually to empty out this bag in this life itself. So we're not reborn.
Do they believe that there's a period of time before you're reborn?
Well, there are different concepts, and it varies from which belief system you follow and all that. So like where I come from, the northern part of India, the belief system is that when the physical body disappears, the soul, which is this subtle body, which is a collection of soul and everything else that goes with it, it hovers around in this land called where there are terms for all this, for 14 days. Since you asked that, okay? And it's only on the 14th day it will find a new body. So when a person dies, actually, there are rituals which people perform for 14 days. Every day. All right? Okay. All right, anyway. I'm looking at the time and there is so much more to cover.
Can I ask one thing, only because I'm good with finite stuff?
Yeah, please.
Do you know where the 14 days came from?
No.
Because I would envision in my mind that probably after whatever's after here doesn't, like, stick to our time clock.
No, it doesn't.
I mean,
it's a belief system that's prevalent in the northern part of the country. But then, there are other...
I like it. I just want
there are other belief systems which say that depending on what your karma was, you can be hovering around for millennia. Mm. Okay? Other belief systems. Okay? And then they give you these seven different stages or seven different worlds, so to say, that the spirit can hover in, and there are names to all these seven, and each one has a different time duration. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's the lowest one, which is supposed to have 14 days. Mm-hmm. If you happen to have go into the higher one, it could be much longer. Mm-hmm. And Bhuloka, Bhuvarloka, and I can give you all these seven names, but it doesn't mean anything here.
That's interesting. I mean, just different belief systems, and they all have so many similarities.
Yes. Okay.
I think I missed. What was the third type of karma?
Agami. A-G-A-M-I. That's the one that we are creating in this life through our will, free will, as this switches to say. Okay, so the goal of yoga, again to repeat that, is to diminish the role of the ego and make the intellect more dominant, and make the intellect such that it is driven more by the pure intuitive wisdom and not by the ego. That's the goal of yoga. And that is very beautifully stated in the sutra that introduces the eight limbs of yoga. Okay? And I don't remember the sutra number, maybe 27, 28. In any case, I'm going to give you that sutra because it's a very beautiful sutra. It introduces the whole concept of the eight limbs of yoga. So the sutra in Sanskrit is Yogang Anushthanat Ashuddhikshaye Jnan Deeptihi Avivek Khyatehe. Okay, now I'm going to explain that because it's a very important sutra because it introduces the eight limbs of yoga. Okay?
It is 28.
I think roughly in that area.
Yeah.
Okay. So, what does the sutra mean now? What it means is, Patanjali is introducing the concept of the eight limbs of yoga. So, he says that through the practice of these eight limbs of yoga, that's the first word, yogang anushthanat. Anushthana means practice. So through the practice of these eight limbs of yoga, ashuddhikshaye, that means all the impurities of the mind will dwindle down. All the impurities of the mind will dwindle down. Pay attention, very careful attention to each word because it's very meaningful. This sutra is beautiful. Okay, people tend to ignore this because this is what the crux of the whole practice is. What are the impurities of the mind?
The ego.
It gives rise to what impurities of the mind?
Attachments.
Depression, anxiety, anger, jealousy, hatred, all those things, right? Greed. These are all the impurities of the mind. Every one of them. And what it says is through the practice of these eight limbs of yoga, these impurities will dwindle down. They will come down. They will be much reduced or eliminated. Ashuddhikshaye, elimination. Jnana deeptihi. Jnana means knowledge, pure knowledge, not worldly knowledge, knowledge, true knowledge. The light of true knowledge will shine. Deepti means light. So when you practice yoga, because all these impurities are going to be diminished, now the light of true knowledge can shine through. True, pure, intuitive knowledge will shine through. Jnana Deeptihi, Avivek Khyatehi. And it will keep happening until we reach the state of pure discriminatory wisdom. Viveka Khyati means pure discriminatory wisdom. That means I am now able to distinguish between good and bad, real and unreal, everything. I have a clear understanding, a very beautiful understanding of what is and what is not. That means I know myself. That's called self-realization. So this practice of eight limbs of yoga through this purification of the mind, of the impurities, it can lead me to my state of self-realization. Very profound statement. So again, please study that sutra very carefully. People tend to ignore that sutra. To me, that's a very, very important sutra. Okay? And then, of course, it goes into the discussion of these eight limbs of yoga. And very quickly, we only have about 10 more minutes, 15 minutes left. What are the eight limbs of yoga? Anybody want to mention those?
Yama.
Go ahead.
Yama.
Yamas.
Niyama.
Asana. Let's not pronounce. Okay. Correction in pronunciation. Please do not pronounce it as asana. It's asana.
Asana.
Okay, go ahead.
Pranayama.
Pratyahara.
Dharana.
Dharana. Again, not dharana.
Okay.
It's dharana.
Dharana.
Mm-hmm.
Dhyana.
Mm-hmm.
Samadhi.
Eight limbs of yoga. Yamas and Niyamas. Melissa, are you going to talk about these Yamas and Niyamas?
Yes, we have already.
You already have talked?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then we focus on one each month of the training.
Oh, you have been doing that?
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. So then you should know what these five Yamas are. Anybody want to?
Ahimsa, Satya.
Can you do them out of memory or no?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet.
Okay. Ahimsa, Satya.
Asteya.
Mm-hmm.
Brahmacharya.
Brahmacharya.
Ah, okay. Brahmacharya.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And aparigraha.
Very good, very good.
But I thought it was Brahmacharya.
Yeah, Brahmacharya.
Oh, Brahmacharya.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, if you look in the, you'll see it's not spelled with a C.
Oh,
it's B-R-A-H.
Brahmacharya.
Yeah, it's Brahmacharya.
Brahmacharya.
Yeah. So since you're going to go through these, and you already have kind of, I'm not going to cover these, all right? But let's list the five niyamas.
Saucha.
Uh-huh.
Saucha.
Santosha.
Tapas.
Tapas, yeah.
Svadhyaya.
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 Mm-hmm.
Pranidhana.
Yes, beautiful. You got it. Ishvara Pranidhana. Very nice. And you all know the meanings in English of all these words?
Okay.
So I don't have to go through that.
Yeah.
We have them somewhere in here.
Yes, we do.
Okay.
We do have them. We have it
in our little posters.
Yeah,
okay.
So they made a little tree of yoga poster.
Oh, that's good, okay. And then, of course, we have these five yamas and niyamas. They are kind of the guidelines for moral and ethical behavior. Essentially, that's what they are, okay? Moral and ethical guidelines. Then asana, the number three. What does the word asana mean, literal meaning? What kind of posture?
Yoga.
What kind of yoga posture? Asana literally means?
A sitting posture.
It comes from the root word in Sanskrit, which means, the root word is as, which means to sit. As means to sit. And asana means either a posture that I'm sitting in or what I'm sitting on. So, in this particular case, I am sitting in this posture called Sukhasana, S-U-K-H-A, and I am sitting on a bolster, which is my asana. Okay, so this bolster or a chair or your wherever you sit, that's asana, and the posture that you make while you're sitting, it's called the asana. So, asana means a sitting posture. It's a much later derivation where when people started sitting for, because everything is all related to meditation. Patanjali did not talk about warrior pose and inversion pose and headstand and handstand. No, he didn't talk about that. All he said is sit and meditate. That's all. That's all his interest was. It's only through meditation you can attain the goal of yoga, to calm the mind. Later on, what happened is when you start sitting for meditation, after 5 minutes, people found their knee hurts, they have to do this, their shoulder hurts, their back hurts. So they had to develop this whole science of Hatha Yoga, which is to practice all these other postures, so to say, and pranayama and everything, so that you can become strong and healthy enough so you can sit and meditate for a long period of time, eventually. Goal is still meditation, nothing else. The whole goal of all these practices, meditation. Okay, but now when these people developed all these different postures, they said, should we give it a new name or should we use what Patanjali has given? They said, all right, we'll just use the word asana. Even though literally it means the sitting posture, but even for these postures we'll call it asana. It's okay. All right. So that's how the asana word came about. Now, the definition of asana in Patanjali Yoga Sutra is very simple. Two words define asana. Anybody remember the two words?
Sitting posture.
sthira sukham, two words in Sanskrit. Sthira means firm and steady, unmoving, unshaking, very steady. And sukham means very comfortable. So if I'm sitting like this, should be very steady. That means I shouldn't have any need to move, you know, twitch around and all that. Firm and steady, no trembling, no shaking. And it should be very comfortable. Okay. And then the same definition is extended to all the other postures. If you are in a headstand, it should be very firm and steady and very comfortable. If you are in a warrior pose, it should be very steady and comfortable. How do you get there? The very next sutra it says, a beautiful definition of asana. And I forget the number. I think 43 or something. 43? 44?
47?
Okay. Sthira Sukham Asanam is 47?
No, Sthira
Sukham Asanam is 46. 47 then is Prayatna Shaithalyam Ananta Samapatti Bhyam. Okay, it's a very beautiful statement. How do you get to that state of being firm and stable and very comfortable? Through letting go of all unnecessary effort, letting go of all mental effort. You set the intention to be in a pose, but let go of any unnecessary, oh, my ego says I must touch my toes, you know, oh, keep doing it, you know. Let go of that. And Ananta Samapatti, the word Samapatti means meditation. Ananta means deep, a deep state of meditation. When you're practicing asana, he says, when you're practicing asana, you have a certain experience of the asana, at the physical level, at the mental level, an experience, right? My muscle might be stretching, my hamstring might be stretching, my spine might be feeling it. It's an experience. Can you meditate on that experience? No matter what it is. Become one with that experience. That's awesome. And we just, you know, keep doing it mechanically, but he says, think about it. Become one with that experience. That's why, you know, these sutras are so beautiful, so important to understand. It'll tell you everything. Right? So just don't do these asanas mechanically. Please get into a state of meditation in every asana. See what's going on. What does that mean? That means you cannot practice yoga while you're watching TV. Because then you cannot focus. You can meditate. You cannot meditate on your own experience. You cannot practice yoga while listening to music, talking to somebody. It's a very personal, very individual experience. Right? So that's asana. And then pranayama is all. What's pranayama? Breathing practices. Okay? Now pranayama also he gives a few, you know, different sutras, but one of them is very important, which says there are these different variables that can be used to vary our breath. Okay? Desha, Kala, Sankhya, I forget the sutra number, could be right after those. Desha means, well, let's not go through that because we don't have time. Okay, but there are several variables that Patanjali defines as to these are the variables which we can use to develop our breathing practices. And then subsequent yogis, they use these variables to design a very large number of breathing practices, pranayama. Okay? Now, one of the sutras in the toward the end of this pranayama discussion, he says that pranayama takes you to the doorstep of meditation. Okay? Dharanasu yogyata, that's the sutra in Patanjali's statement. Which means pranayama has the ability to take you very close to starting your meditation practice. Because it has the ability to calm the nerves, calm the mind, give you a little enough energy so you can sustain that whole meditation for a long period of time. Okay? So pranayama is very important in that sense. It leads you to that. What is pratyahara? Number 5.
Going inside yourself.
That means you are able to withdraw the mind from any influence from the 5 senses. That's kind of going inwards. Okay? And then the final 3 are this different stages of meditation. Dharana, Dhyana and Samadhi. That's what is called Sanyama in Patanjali's language. And I have 2 more presentations, both focusing on those aspects of meditation, which we have no time for now. Okay. So those last 2 presentations, it's all focusing on all the sutras that discuss meditation in depth. And if there is anybody interested, I'm offering this meditation intensive starting May 1st. It's a 14-day program, every day in the morning, 6 o'clock, 6 to 7.30, I'll be doing a class. The major focus is meditation there. Okay. So you're welcome to join that class if you have the time. Okay, now it's 12:30 in my watch, and according to Melissa, it's time to wind up. If you have any questions, let me know.
Where's your class? Where's your class?
The class that I teach is in Morrisville,
okay,
off of Aviation Parkway. It's close to the intersection of Aviation and the 54. Yes, yes, and you know, I'm going to add you to my email list.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and of course, anytime you want to unsubscribe, you can always do that. You know that. You know, you can just hit unsubscribe, and you will not receive any more emails from me.
I think I'm already on your list.
Oh, good, good. So yeah, it's starting May 1st, and every morning at 6 o'clock. You know, so. I'll be doing that. All right, so the things that I have not been able to discuss, like I said, are all the different stages of meditation. Okay? All right, and there are many different stages of meditation that Patanjali talks about. The word dharana means the initial focus or the initial state of concentration. Okay, and there are multiple techniques given in multiple texts. Patanjali gives a few, but then there are many other texts which are focused on that initial focus called dharana. Then Patanjali talks a great deal on meditation itself. What does it mean? Different stages of meditation and samadhi. And in Sutra 17 and 18, for example, he talks about those different stages of samadhi in chapter 1. Then toward the end of chapter 1, Sutra 41 through all the way to the end of chapter 1, more details on the different stages of samadhi or meditation. And he goes through, you know, the gross level of meditation, the subtle level of meditation, the meditation at the very blissful state, etc., etc. You know, many different stages of meditation. Okay. Then he moves on to chapter 3, where he talks about what goes on in the mind during meditation, transformation. What changes are going on in the mind? Now, those are the sutras which I like to spend time on, but you know, some other day maybe. I love those sutras because they tell you exactly what's going on in the mind when you meditate. All right. And the final end goal, end result is that we become self-realized. That means myself, my true nature is now separated from the mind-body complex. We're all done. We're all fat, dumb and happy at that point. No more worries, nothing to worry about. Okay. Are we okay with this now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
All right.
Thank you so much.
Let's close the eyes just one last time. Sit up straight. We'll recite just Om once only now. So let's take a deep inhalation. Let's join the palms together. And we'll close by just reciting the word for peace three times. I'll do it first, then we'll do it together. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Together. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Thank you all very much. Thank you. Namaste. And have a wonderful rest of the day. And
Thank you so much.
Enjoy your program. When do you graduate?
October.
October, okay.
Do you post like a picture?